Allah salam alaikum. Happy Christmas and shalom. MTK on the MIC reporting from the holy land of the monotheisms known as Islam, Christianity, and Judaism. For the next 2 weeks in this special KPFK news report, we'll be bringing you the sounds and voices of Palestine and Israel deadlocked in conflict as we travel throughout the region. Today, the city of Jerusalem remains divided, and walking the streets of the old city, one can hear pilgrims of all faiths. But one also hears the roar of bulldozers and land movers, the sounds of drastic change. George Walker Bush has given a brief and perhaps temporary nod to the Geneva Accords, and establishment media is making sure everyone in the world knows about it. Yet few here seem to want to talk favorably about the Geneva peace talks, authored by expatriated Palestinian refugees and unempowered former Israeli officials. To many, the Oslo process of 1993 is all but dead, and these Geneva Accords smack of an Oslo II, and thus not a progressive step at all. Bush's roadmap to peace has collapsed into a roadblock of freeways and fences as the Israeli settlements and radical Palestinian bombings continue. The first Palestinian prime minister the roadblock attempted to authorize resigned, accused of being a spy for the CIA, leaving the second as impotent as Palestinian President Yasser Arafat, who remains to this moment locked down and immobilized, just a few dozen miles north of here in Ramallah. One could call it house arrest if there were a house around him, rather than a decrepit concrete building that has mostly collapsed into rubble. The second Intifada, or People's Uprising, continues, and throughout the region, the thunder of Bush's war in Iraq haunts prospects for peace. Connie Hackbarth is a member of the Israeli radical left, Israelis for a Just Peace and to End the Occupation. She is the advocacy coordinator for the Alternative Information Center, or AIC, in the municipality of New Jerusalem. The AIC is one of the very few joint Palestinian-Israeli organizations that exist here. It was founded in 1984, some 10 years before the Oslo peace process began. In 1987, the AIC was shut down, its Jewish-Israeli director imprisoned, and it was charged with being an accessory to a terrorist organization. It survives today as a totally radical organization in Israeli society, committed to very specific ideals for peace.
For us, ending the occupation is a starting point. The minute you do that, then we can sit down and talk about peace. Ending the occupation is not the end of the process, it's the start of the process. And the AIC is very clear about what ending the occupation means. It means complete withdrawal from all territories occupied in 1967, obviously including East Jerusalem, complete dismantlement of all settlements that Israel has built, obviously including those in East Jerusalem, and the right of return for Palestinian refugees. For us, this is a starting point. These are not points to be negotiated between governments. Once the Israeli government accepts these points, we can sit down with the Palestinians and say, how can we possibly, after all 50 years at least of damage, how can we possibly work out a way to live together?
Hackbarth says that since the launch of the most recent Intifada in October of 2000, women have remained among the few who are deeply committed to peace.
The vast majority of Israeli peace groups disappeared when the Intifada broke out, so I don't know how peace they actually were. But there are some radical groups, and I should emphasize that women are at the forefront. Without women, there would be no progressive Israeli peace movement. Women are certainly doing the work. Women were at the forefront of forming the Women's Coalition for Just Peace, which was the first umbrella organization of smaller groups that was able to overcome very important ideological differences and form together as a group. Women really led the way there. Unfortunately, we suffer from a lot of the same problems that mainstream society does. The activists may be women, the directors are usually men, and this is something we need to work on.
The AIC remains committed to getting information out about radical organizations with alternatives to the current peace plans.
Another example, there's a group called Ta'ayush, which is a joint Arab, Israeli, Palestinian, Israeli, Jewish, Israeli group that was formed when the Intifada broke out. And they do so-called humanitarian actions, but for political reasons. They'll break through a checkpoint to bring food to an isolated village, for example. We're trying to create a model of not coexistence, two people living side by side, but two people actually living together, working together. Now, even people who are talking about peace are talking about separation. Israelis here, Palestinians here. The AIC and groups like Ta'ayush were saying, no, peace when we're working together. For moral reasons, for practical reasons, this is a very small area of the world. So So we're trying to figure out models of how people can actually work together.
Listening to Connie Hackbarth and the others at the AIC immediately brings to mind the question of the single state solution to the Israel-Palestine problem. But Hackbarth says that the view of a single state is very different from outside the region.
The discourse of people living here is very different from that of people living abroad. Both Israelis and Palestinians abroad are speaking of different issues. For example, Palestinians here speak primarily about 1967 occupation and what's happened. Palestinians I know abroad and also some Israelis talk about 1948. Neither is more legitimate, it's just a matter of daily concerns. It's important to note that 98% of Israelis and over 90% of Palestinians are opposed to a one-state solution. It's a very marginal and radical view. Secondly, it's not necessarily better. If there was a way to completely dismantle the Israeli occupation, and if both the Israelis and the Palestinians decided they want two states, then that's obviously the best solution. Realistically, if we look on the ground, the number of settlements, the bypass roads, the checkpoints, I just don't know how we could ever make two states a viable, practical solution. Now, on a different level, I personally have problems with the state of Israel being defined in ethnic ways and not in democratic, humane ways. That's my own interpretation.
Maybe you could describe for us what a single state solution someday down the road might be like in your imagining.
I think this is something that would have to be worked out by the people living here. So I really don't, that's such a long-term vision. I don't have specifics for it, and no one is talking about it, to be honest.
And you mentioned the idea of trying to bring that to the discourse.
Sure.
How do you go about doing that with people who are so polarized?
First of all, we're realistic about who we can talk to about those options. We, first of all, approach progressive Israeli groups and say, let's talk about a one-state solution. They're obviously much more open to doing that than the average Israeli on the streets. So we're realistic about that. Secondly, we also want to widen what that could mean, a one-state solution, without being unrealistic. It's clear that's not going to happen tomorrow. It's also clear that we will go through some sort of stage of two states. That's clear. It's also a matter of priorities. Ending the occupation is our top priority because it's the most pressing issue. Ending the occupation will not end the Israeli-Arab conflict, though. The Israeli-Arab conflict, this is where we go into questions of where does Israel fit in the region. Is Israel a Middle Eastern state? Not really.
Connie Hackbarth, Advocacy Director for the AIC in Jerusalem. To learn more about the Alternative Information Center, go to www.alternativenews.org. Reporting from Jerusalem for the KPFK News, this is M.T. Karthik. Because the resistance in Iraq is unlikely to end with the capture of Saddam Hussein, what we see on the ground here in Palestine is likely to be what we see on the ground in occupied Iraq. Already it's happening. Perhaps it will be conducted at home in the United States, in our airports, our public parks and schools. It is division of society and various manifestations of what Jeff Halper calls a matrix of control. After the checkpoints, the most visible manifestation of that matrix here in Palestine is the wall, what some have come to call the apartheid barrier, or the apartheid wall. The name is not an exaggeration. It labels what is effectively a huge separation project begun by the Israelis in June of 2002, mandated by Israeli military orders on the grounds of security, but that takes acres and acres of land from the Palestinians. The apartheid barrier reminds one most of the Iron Curtain in Berlin, or the DMZ in Korea. MTK on the MIC reporting from just outside the village of Jayus. I am standing near the apartheid barrier. Here it takes the form of an enormous barbed wire fence, about 8 feet high and 5 feet deep of looped barbed wire. Past that, a trench. The trench is about 12 feet deep and 15 feet across. When you pass the trench, you come to the electrified fence, some 20 feet away from the barbed wire. It's about 17 feet high and it has an electrical current running through it. At the top, barbed wire once again. Past that, you find the road that the Israeli military uses to patrol this border that they themselves have created illegally. Many people living in Jayus are farmers. They have for centuries produced all around the year, from season to season, olives, oranges, fruits, loquats, kumquats. The situation here is quite grave, as farmers have been cut off from their lands and their livelihoods. But more than a separation between cultures, the apartheid barrier is an aggressive move by Israel to claim land. It is not being built along the Green Line, which is the established 1967 border between Israel and the West Bank. Instead, most of the route of the wall is inside the West Bank. Palestinians living along the newly erected barrier have limited access to hospitals, schools, jobs, and their own family members on the other side. Abdel Latif Khaled is with the Palestinian Hydrology Group in Jayous.
In this village, we have about 3,200 persons who are living here. Most of them are farmers. 12,500 dunum, the total area of this village, or 1,250 hectares. Now, underneath the wall, we lost 55 hectares. And we have, in addition to that, about 800 and 60 hectares, or 8,600,000 square meters. We have our area in this small village, agricultural village, now seized behind the wall. In our village, we have 300 families who are totally dependent on the land underneath the wall and behind the wall, out of 550 families. Without working, without reaching this land, they will lose their source of living. Simply because we have 1 million cubic meter of water behind the wall. And after the wall completed, we have no drop of water for this village. We have 2,000 dunums of irrigated lands, which it is cultivated with all kinds of fruits and citrus. We have about 120 greenhouses behind the wall. One greenhouse is one dunum, or 0.1 hectare, 1,000 square meter, produces annually about 40,000 kilograms of tomato. Then we are talking, according to our statistics, about 9 million kilograms of vegetables, fruits, and oranges. We normally produce it from the area behind the wall for the local market in the main cities. Because in Hebron, in Bethlehem, in Jerusalem and Ramallah, Nablus, they are cities without irrigated practices. Therefore, they are our market. From a small village, we are producing 9 million kilograms, 1 million cubic meter. Then we could imagine, when we are talking about 55 villages, what kind of numbers we are talking about, and what kind of impact in a very short period that will take place upon the Palestinian economy.
In early October of this year, the Israeli military declared the area between stage one of the barrier and the Green Line to be a closed military zone. This area is home to 11,400 people who now require a permanent resident permit to continue living in their homes. Other residents are forced to obtain special permits to enter the area. In Jayous, more than 1,800 permits would have been required to allow the 300-plus farming families to have full access to their land. The Israelis granted only 700 permits. Of these, most were granted to families living outside the area and even abroad in the United States, Europe, and Australia. Sharif M.O. Khalid is one of those who has not been able to reach his own land.
Me as a farmer, as for marketing, I want to say something. From the beginning of the Second Intifada, our trucks are prohibited to go to our cities, where the principal market is there, because of the barriers, because of the checkpoints. In the same time, we are also forbidden to send our products to Israeli cities. It is the same. But in the same time also, the Israeli products, they load it with their trucks because they have the permission to use the bypass roads, which is specialized for the settlers and for the army only. So our people inside our cities, they eat the Israeli products in the time that our products fall down most of the time on the ground about the pyramids. In fact, the gates are a big deception. And the pyramids also is a deception because they issue the pyramids for children, for died women, for those who are living outside the Palestine. As example, we have a farmer called Isam Ahmed Abdurrahman. He has five greenhouses here. and he used a lot of workers daily to achieve his work in these greenhouses. His brother is an engineer. From 1990, he went to Australia and he lived there. His brother in Australia have this permit, but Islam has this permit to go daily for the farm. Myself, I am a farmer. I have 175 dunams there. Most of them are irrigated. I am the first farmer in Jayus. I usually send 40 tons of loquat to our markets. This means that I am the first farmer in loquat in the Kalkili district, not only in Jayus. But now, also, I haven't permit to go to my land. No one of my sons or my daughters. They issue a permit for my wife, who has pinned back and she can't work in the farmers. It's an example.
In some places, a wall 25 to 30 feet high has been erected in place of the barrier system. The estimated cost is $2.5 million per kilometer, for a total of more than $2 billion for the entire section approved by the cabinet so far. Stage 1 has been completed, surrounding Jayus and areas such as Tul Karim. Stages 2, 3, and 4 threaten to do the same to acres upon acres of Palestinian land around the West Bank. For more information about resistance to the apartheid barrier in towns like Jayus, check out www.stopthewall.org. That's one word, stopthewall.org.
They've been doing this for many years. They've been doing it since the 70s, is what they're doing.
The plan for Iraq is to be like Palestine.
The ISIL pictures broadcasted from Iraq, how they do the house-to-house search, the aggression in the face, how they get in the houses. For a moment, I don't know if it's in the West Bank or if it's in Iraq. You can never tell. For some seconds, you can never tell. House to house search. The ISIL pictures broadcasted from Iraq. House to house search. For a moment, I don't know if it's in the West Bank or if it's in Iraq. House to house search. They've been doing it since the 70s, is what they're doing.
The plan for Iraq is to be like Palestine. The plan for Iraq is to be like Palestine.
House to house search.
Nablus was the home to most of Palestinian industry until the Israeli military incursion in April of 2002. Dr. Hassan Hamda is with Palestine Medical Relief Society, stationed at a makeshift clinic in Nablus.
During April invasion, when they invade the old city, we had more than 360 people who was injured, and mostly they are civilian people. More than 83 people dead, killed by when they shoot by from the helicopters by using the heavy weapons like 500 millimeters, 800 millimeters weapons. You can't decide that this is militant or this is a civilian people. And what kind of military we have? We have symbol fighters who have their symbol Kalashnikov or M16 and small pistols. And they will face the most powerful tanks in the whole world. Merkava 3 or Merkava 2, and they will face the Apache helicopters, Americans helicopters. So, and the F-16 planes, they use 1,000 tons of explosive materials to blow all these buildings. And it's the oldest buildings in this city. So they are targeting also not the humans only, but the culture of this city.
The Israelis haven't stopped since April of 2002. They impose curfews on the populace, often for extended periods of time. Once, according to Dr. Hamda, for 119 days in a row, during which the Palestinians could not go out of their homes at night. In conflicts between Israelis and local Palestinians, the Israeli forces even fired upon ambulances and medical relief personnel wearing the internationally recognized symbol of the Red Crescent, a direct violation of the Geneva Conventions. Dr. Hamda showed us photos of his ambulance riddled with bullet holes and told us one of his volunteer medical personnel was struck and disabled in that incident. Sharon's forces then proceeded to establish a checkpoint at the front of the city of Nablus, where the industrial plants were located, successfully shutting down Palestinian industry in the area and reducing more than 75% of the population to under the poverty line of $2 per day.
This city, it's the biggest city in West Bank. This city should be the industrial city also and the richest city in West Bank, Nablus City. But during the last 3 years, especially after imposing the closures and invasions and curfews, the industrial area was near the entrance of the city, and there is a checkpoint there. So it was, since 3 years, closed completely. Because of that, all these factories, all this industrial work, it was collapsed since that time. And the people, they lost their businesses, they lost their money, and they lost the workers there.
But they didn't stop there. The Israelis then dug trenches around the villages surrounding Nablus and filled them with raw sewage. Dr. Hamda says the result has been increases in diseases that medical science has long had controlled, like amoebiasis and hepatitis A.
There is no distance between the city and the villages. It's a small distance. It's not like in Europe. You should drive your car for 2 hours or 3 hours to reach the village. Here, no. It's just 5 to 7 minutes, 15 minutes maximum. All the medical facilities, especially the hospitals, it's centralized. Yeah, it's in the cities. But when they imposed the closure, they closed the area totally, completely. So the villagers, they couldn't reach the hospitals here. Because of that, for example, I can give you statistics. Before the closure, 100% of the pregnant women, they should give their birth in the hospitals. After the closure, more than 45% of the women, they give their birth at homes with viral complications and without medical services, without medical people. So you can imagine what kind of condition they will have. And because of that, we have, for example, here in this area, 15 children who was died because they was born in the villages, at home. Yeah. And there is another fact which says that we don't have also in each village primary health care center. So because of that, many villagers, many people, they didn't have medical services during the last 3 years. Three villages here, it's just 5 minutes by car, Salem, Azmoud, Deir al-Hatab. All these villages were surrounded by trench. The Israelis, they make a trench, and they surround these villages, and they cut the main road between the city and the villages, and they fill these trenches with sewage water. There is a settlement there, Alon Mori and Itmar, which surrounded all these villages, and they fill all these trenches by sewage water. So the people, the sick people, the pregnant women, they should cross this trench by their foot. What we had as a common disease, which should be finished here in this area, like hepatitis, for example. During the last 3 years, we have many cases which affected or suffered of hepatitis A. Because of the sewage water, because of the closure, because of their farms was also full of sewage water from these settlements. Their plants also affected because of that. So, for example, in Salem village, once when we make screening for the people, we found 146 patients who are affected by hepatitis A.
Like Jenin to the north and Ramallah to the south, Nablus is a broken city since the April 2002 incursion. Deep within the West Bank and with no Israeli settlements near to justify Israeli attacks, Nablus is continually under assault by Israeli forces and remains the strongest evidence of Israeli terrorism. I interviewed families whose homes have been invaded and occupied by soldiers less than 6 months ago. I witnessed cruel harassment at the checkpoints in front of the city. Despite the attacks, Nablus is a proud Palestinian city. Walking the streets, one sees flags and banners with photos of the Shaheed, the martyrs who have died fighting Israel, wheat-pasted to the walls. Cleanly cut stenciled graffiti and slogans for the Intifada pepper the central mosque in the city, which flies the flag of Hamas. This past week, even as the talk of peace in the Middle East surfaces with Hanukkah and Christmas upon us, Israeli forces entered the Parata refugee camp, a site protected by international law. and killed a 10-year-old boy there, injuring 14 others. And just hours before Ariel Sharon's speech yesterday, in which he publicly embraced the U.S.-backed roadmap to peace and declared that Israel did not want to control the Palestinians, a firefight in Nablus broke out, ending with the death of four Palestinians. From Nablus, deep in occupied Palestine, this is MT Karthik for KPFK News.